convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily the views of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guest. And this afternoon, our guest is David Rothkopf, and we're going to be talking about his book, Running the World, the Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. And this is the definitive story of the National Security Council, which probably most people really don't know too much about, and yet this is the organization that in recent years really has been the determinant of American foreign policy, and the people in this organization are the people who determine what is going to happen to our nation. And certainly it is an analysis based upon, I think, about 130 interviews that Mr. Rothkopf did with the people who've been associated with the National Security Council. Certainly if you look at the people who've commented on this, people like O. Zygmunt Brzezinski and certainly the Sandy Berger. And one of the most significant points that that is made is the fact that since Henry Kissinger was the National Security Advisor, there have been about 13 chairmen of the National Security Council since then, and every one of them has either worked for Henry Kissinger or has certainly worked for somebody who worked for Henry Kissinger. So his influence is very profound there. Is that a fair statement, Mr. Rothkopf?
Sure. It's a very, very closely knit community. And the role that Dr. Kissinger's played is a particularly significant one. But I really offered that sort of 2 degrees of Henry Kissinger model up to illustrate that, you know, the people in making U.S. foreign policy often went to the same schools together, have known each other most of their lives, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. And this has some benefits because people have histories together and a long experience. And it has some deficiencies because you can easily, in that kind of environment, get into groupthink. And conventional wisdom can dominate, given the tight-knit nature of this exclusive group.
Well, of course, this is the concern that many of us have, is that here's a group of people who are not elected by the public at all, and they have an agenda, and it's really more of a globalist agenda, and they really believe that America should lead the world. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, I think that, yes and no. There are a large number of people who served in these groups who have never been elected to a public office. And they've played an enormously important role. And in fact, the National Security Advisor to the President is not congressionally approved, as are cabinet members. And the NSC staff, because it's the President's staff, operates with a certain degree of autonomy and secrecy that doesn't exist in other kinds of agencies. Of course, at the core of the NSC, you do have elected officials like the President and the Vice President. And there are degrees of debate within the group about whether or not the United States should play an actively globalist role or not. So there's some debate. I mean, it's not that it's a monolithic group that's got a secret agenda, but their views are closer together than perhaps representing the full range of views that are out there among the American people.
Well, do you think that they represent the views of the American people, or the people that certainly more or less an aristocracy that has a different worldview than the average individual?
Well, my sense is that, for the most part, the people that I met and that I spoke with were earnest, well-intentioned public servants.
And a whole lot of thought, because we'll be right back here in just a moment, and I have no question at all that they are earnest and dedicated. This is going to be a fascinating interview. Please hang on there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is David Rothkopf, and he has written a wonderful, wonderful book called Running the World, and it's the story of the National Security Council and the people who have really run the National Security Council since it was formed back in 1947. And David was simply saying that this is not a monolithic group, although the people many times go to the same schools and hold many of the same views, that these people have a the responsibility for determining American foreign policy, and doesn't that really impact, because of America's power, America today really the lone superpower, doesn't that really impact upon what happens everywhere in the world today?
Well, it certainly does. I would argue that the National Security Council are the core group of people around the President of the United States who help him make international decisions are probably the most powerful committee in the history of the world. Because, you know, whether you speak of the consuls of ancient Rome or the Holy Roman Emperor, you know, Charlemagne, or the court of Queen Victoria when Britain ruled the waves, none of them had the ability to project more force to more places more rapidly with more impact on more people than this small group does.
And of course, at one point you make that, the point who, the man who whispers into the ear of the king many times has more influence than the king himself. Would that be a fair statement?
Of course, and I think that one of the reasons that that's true is that the people around the president who are most influential are often less accountable than the president himself, who after all has to stand for election and is more public and is more open to scrutiny because of the nature of our system. But that's been true in society since the dawn of time. And you always develop a kind of a court class that hovers in the shadows and brokers power without getting too far out into public scrutiny.
And I think that this book is really fascinating because it's based upon interviews with about 130, is that a fair figure, 130 people?
130, yeah.
130 people who make up the National Security Council, have been close to it, or worked with the people or for the people involved in the National Security Council. And this is really more the center of American foreign policy. And this book really chronicles what's happened going back to 1947 and where the organization wasn't that important. And then, of course, with the advent of Henry Kissinger in the late 1960s and early 1970s, this then suddenly became almost the major force in American foreign policy. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, no, I think the real turning point in the history of the NSC came when Nixon...
Hold that thought for just a moment. We're going to bring our stations on. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were talking about the history of the NSC, formed in 1947 to advise the president, and then during the Nixon administration, when Henry Kissinger is in a key place, why suddenly the NSC, the National Security Council, which is really the organization that determines the policies of the most powerful nation, not only in the world today, but the most powerful nation that there has ever been. Under President Nixon, why Henry Kissinger, you pick up the story there.
Well, you know, Nixon was ill at ease with the bureaucracy. He had, I guess, some scars from his time as vice president. He, frankly, was an awkward man in kind of intimate face-to-face situations. And so he wanted an interlocutor to act as the man he could speak to about foreign policy, which he cared about very much, but who would then go and implement it. And the man he picked, Henry Kissinger, was somebody who was not only extraordinarily capable in this regard, but he was one who was extraordinarily ambitious. And he wanted to take advantage of the fact that he was given this kind of unique position by Nixon. And gradually, over time, he not only elevated the National Security Council to unique status in American life, but he became the only person to be both National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. And, you know, effectively, particularly during the Watergate period, became what you might consider to be the Deputy President of the United States for Foreign Policy, including at one point when Nixon was kind of in his cups one night, knocked around from the problems of Watergate and not in Kissinger's mind really accessible for a thoughtful discussion. Kissinger ordered the nuclear forces of the United States on alert, even though the National Security Advisor is not in the chain of command and was in no position to do it. But, you know, this kind of thing happens periodically. When the system adapts to big personalities, Dick Cheney ordered planes to scramble, even though the vice president doesn't have the authority to do that either. This gets to one of the core points that I wanted to make, which is, you know, you go to college and you study this stuff and you get a lot of political theory and policy theory and organizational charts and so forth. And at the end of the day, the real driving force is personality. Individuals, their idiosyncrasies, their relationships with one another. And that's why it's so important for the people to whom all this really important committee ultimately reports, which is the American people, to understand what's going on in the shadows.
But, of course, the average American has no idea who really is working behind this, the scenes, whispering in the president's or whispering in the king's ear. This is the thing that was really sort of surprising to me. In fact, before I read Richard Clark's book, Against All Enemies, I really didn't even know what the NSC was or what the principles were. In fact, I don't think that most people understand who is on the NSC or who is on this council, what the principles are, and, of course, how this all interlocks. Would you like to briefly give us, our listeners out across America, some insight into who these people are, how it works?
The way I like to characterize it is that there are kind of three NSCs. You know, there's the official NSC, which is the president, the vice president, secretary of state, secretary of defense, cabinet-level people, the principals that you're talking about. There is the NSC staff, which is the people who work for the National Security Advisor in the White House. Could be 100 professionals, sometimes as many as 200 people overall. And these are people who schedule things, write speeches, write policy papers, advise the president on who to see and where to travel. And then there's the unofficial NSC. And this could be all of the people I just mentioned, plus it could be the president's father, his wife, his brother, his friends, congressmen, people who have special access to the president. And it's some combination of interactions with these three clusters of people that ultimately enables the president to shape his opinion and act. At the end of the day, of course, it's the president who plays the central role in U.S. foreign policy formation with the council of these groups. But when I went out in the street in Bethesda, Maryland, which is, you know, next to Washington, a suburb of Washington, full of government employees, and I said, what's the NSC? A big chunk of the people I talked to thought I meant the Securities and Exchange Commission. Another chunk thought I meant the National Security Agency, which is a spy agency. And a bunch of other people, you know, didn't know what I was talking about or looked at me and asked, why is this guy asking me this strange question?
Well, of course, now you had the opportunity to interview Richard Clark. And for those of our listeners who don't remember, Richard Clark was the counterterrorism and the czar, counterterrorism czar during the Clinton administration, who was frantically trying to reach the president. Bush, once, of course, President Bush assumed power. But suddenly they changed the structure of the principals. At least he was no longer there. He no longer had access to the principals and to the president. And he was trying to warn them, at least according to Richard Clark, that an attack on America was imminent, and claims he was blocked at every turn. Did he express that feeling to you when you talked to him?
Sure. Well, you know, look, I've known Dick Clark for some time, and Dick Clark is a perfect example of the kind of person in this mix that one needs to be aware of. He was very senior. By the time the Clinton administration came to a close, he had a principal's role, cabinet-level role in coordinating U.S. counterterrorism policy, but he'd served in four administrations. He'd served for Democrats, he'd served for Republicans, and he's kind of part of this permanent bureaucracy that has extraordinary capabilities, a huge amount of influence, and for most of their lives, and in fact for most of them, for all of their lives, are completely unknown to the American people. If it hadn't been for 9/11, would you have ever heard of Dick Clark?
But, of course, Dick Clark's point that he keeps making over and over again is he was trying to warn the Bush administration the attack was coming, that the attack was imminent, that we had to begin preparing for it, and he felt he was being blocked at every turn. Did he express that to you?
Yes, well, he did. I mean, you know, Dick's assertion, and I think it's a fair assertion, is that he came in, tried to brief Condoleezza Rice, tried to brief the president, tried to brief the vice president, tried to make them aware of the growing danger of the terrorist threat, and how we needed to adapt in order to adjust to it. He wasn't saying a bunch of guys are going to go fly a plane into the World Trade Center. He was saying Al-Qaeda is significant, terrorism is significant, the costs of these attacks are going to rise, and we need to make this a top national security priority. But, you know, the Bush administration, to be fair, was going through something that every single administration goes through, and that is it was going through the learning curve, because we have this strange system where most of the senior people in the government get canned whenever we change administrations. And so all the people who are running big agencies in the U.S. government leave. They're replaced by a group of people who may not have been in power for 8 or 12 years, who've got to get themselves up to speed. And so every single new administration goes through a period of a year or 2 years where they're trying to get their sea legs and trying to really get a grip on what's going on in the world. And, of course, the Bush administration had a rude awakening 9 months in when September 11th happened, and all of a sudden they had to take some of their plans and put them on hold, and they had to accelerate some of their engagement in these issues because finally the evidence was present that this was a threat that needed to be addressed and not tomorrow.
Well, I was very interested reading Paul O'Neill's book, The Price of Loyalty. He talked about in January and February attending the meetings of the National Security Council where Rumsfeld and Cheney and Wolfowitz were talking about going to war with Iraq and how were they going to have to convince the American people of preemptive attack. So it would almost appear, if Paul O'Neill is telling the truth, the attack on Iraq was actually planned before 9/11. Did you run into any of that as you began talking to these
absolutely.
People?
Look, the attack on Iraq, and I think this is evident to anybody, regardless of whether they're Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal, wherever at this point, the attack on Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11 or the war on terror. This was an agenda item that came in with Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, with a bunch of the neocons that they had been writing papers about throughout the 90s. It was unfinished business from the first Bush administration, and they were looking for an excuse. And Dick Clark brings up that within hours of 9/11, you already had Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld trying to test the idea to see whether Saddam Hussein could somehow be connected to 9/11 so that they could move on to this agenda item, which had been in the front of their mind and which they'd been preparing for a long time. They then went what I call sort of rationale shopping, where they then tried out a whole bunch of reasons to go after Iraq, and finally arrived at the one that was the only one the Europeans were responding to, which was a WMD threat. And the problem is that, of course, as we've later come to see, the WMD threat in Iraq had actually declined over the embargo years since the first Gulf War. It wasn't what it was characterized to be, and that this rationale that we were offering turned out to be a hollow one.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things of your book, of course, it's always interesting, but I was more interested in, you know, what's going on today. You talk there about Leo Strauss and his influence upon Paul Wolfowitz and many of the other people who form the neocon movement, which really surrounds the president today. Could you sort of develop on that idea? Because I think this is one of the individuals long since dead, but his shadow hangs over Washington, D.C., and over American foreign policy today.
Well, certainly he's a very influential figure within this group called the neocons. And Strauss's views came from, you know, the bitter experience of history, where he felt that kind of relativist approaches to dealing with good and evil were what led to the rise of Hitler, and that the only thing that one could really do was stop, acknowledge that good and evil exist, and sort of embrace a more absolutist approach to things, and that if you were advancing something that was ultimately good, that you would then be given the license of the ends justifying the means. And this sort of led to a lot of the neocon thought. I do think, however, that we sometimes overstate the influence of the neocons. There is a big debate within the bowels of the Bush administration and within the Republican Party between the neocons, the unilateralists, if you will, and the traditionalists.
Hold that thought, please. We're going to have to go to a break here.
A very important book is called AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic. Actually, it's a book I wrote back in 1991 that tells you the story of the politics of the AIDS epidemic and the fact that doctors have been blocked at every turn from doing what was really necessary to stop the spread of this horrible plague, both in the United States and throughout the world. AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, it gives you my story of my effort working with an organized medicine. The fact that the doctors of the state of California consistently voted and supported an effective public health policy, and at every turn their efforts were frustrated by those working with an organized medicine both at the state and national level, and the tragedy is that people are dying in America today unnecessarily. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, because you need to understand the background of this epidemic to understand what is really happening medically in America today.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In November of 1991, the 60 Minutes television show first reported on the French paradox, the fact the French violate every dietary rule for good health, eat a diet rich in fats and calories, and yet exhibit far better cardiovascular health than North Americans. Over a decade later, we know that molecules called polyphenols are responsible for the health benefits in red wine. But those molecules only remain stable in a sealed bottle of red wine. Longevinix is the first dietary supplement to stabilize red wine molecules in a sealed capsule, just like a corked bottle of red wine, providing red wine polyphenols without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives. One Longevinix capsule is equivalent in polyphenols to drinking 5 glasses of red wine. Call 866-405-4000 today to order Longevinix. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000.
Past 3 years, gold and silver have been quietly attracting the attention of the smart money investor. And that's with no small wonder when you consider that in those last 3 years, gold has risen over 50% and silver has nearly doubled. So, are you in profit yet? You might think so if you bought gold or silver coins in the last 3 years. And true enough, some coins have increased by as much as 70%. So how do you know how much your portfolio has gained or lost? With a quick call to the asset management professionals at Colonial Resources. 1-800-685-4042. Colonial Resources will give you current market quotes on your gold or silver bullion and collector coins. If you're ready to sell, Colonial pays higher prices for your coins than almost anyone in the industry. And if you doubt that, call the company that sold them to you and ask what they'd buy them for, and then call us. To find out where you stand in the rapidly changing precious metals market, call Colonial Resources today, toll free. 1-800-685-4042. That's 800-685-4042.
Supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi, this is...
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is David Rothkopf, and we're talking about his book, Running the World. And it's the inside story of the National Security Council, which is really the basic coordinating organization for American foreign policy today. And, of course, American foreign policy, I think, is having some real problems. And I suspect, as you, from reading the book, that you are very, very concerned about what's happening in the Middle East as well. Would that be a fair statement or not?
Absolutely.
All right. And, of course, you point out that you really feel that, of course, George Bush is more or less motivated by his religious beliefs, as if somehow we are on a holy crusade to change the world and bring democracy and freedom to everybody in the world. Is that a fair statement?
I don't know George Bush. Personally, I interviewed 40 people in his administration, including a number of cabinet members and a number of people close to the president. And certainly I don't mean by raising the issues that I raised to in any way suggest that, you know, being a man of faith is inconsistent with being a good president. Quite the contrary. I think those things go hand in hand. But I think the problem with Bush lies more in his sort of avoidance of the kind of careful analysis that needs to underlie global policy decision making. You know, Colin Powell said to me that whereas George Bush's father had more of a sort of an intellectual guide to him in doing what he was doing, that the son, the current president, worked, this Powell's term was kind of on the basis of an inertial navigation system, you know. And you know, that's a problem when you really need to be skeptically analyzing things like the intelligence you're getting, the choices you've got, the risks confronting you, because the stakes are so high. And, you know, there has never been a clearer example in American history of a failure of analysis and a failure of judgment than the decision that led not so much just to going into Iraq, but particularly how we've screwed up the peacekeeping after that.
I'd like to develop a little on that, because I think that's so important. How did we screw up the peacekeeping? And I agree we did, but I don't think the average listener understands what we did that was wrong.
Well, look, I mean, first of all, you know, I want to be very clear. The United States government is full of extraordinarily talented people. And if you looked at the commanding officers of CENTCOM and the plan that they presented 5 years before we went into Iraq on how to go into Iraq and stabilize it, or you looked within the plans that were prepared by the State Department years before we went into Iraq on how to do this, you would have seen all the guidance you needed about whether or not one should keep the Ba'athist Party in place, and whether or not one should keep the military structure in place, and whether or not you needed how many troops you might need in order to do this. And you have top officials in this government, the president's top economic advisor saying it was going to cost $200 to $300 billion and getting fired. The army's chief of staff saying it was going to take 200,000 to 300,000 people and getting fired. The top people in state and defense saying here's the plan and being ignored. So that's what I mean by, you know, a breakdown of the analytical process. We had the information that could have led to the right plan. But because a few people around the president, notably Secretary Rumsfeld and Vice President Cheney, had a different idea that this could be done fast, that this could be done on the cheap, that we were so powerful that these concerns expressed by these other analysts were, you know, unnecessary worrying, that we ended up not sending enough troops, not not keeping in place the aspects of the Iraqi infrastructure that were necessary in order to maintain the peace, and thus wandering out into the swamps that we're in now, where every step we take, we get in deeper and deeper, the costs of getting out get larger and larger, and, you know, you can't undo these wrongs easily. And that, you know, I think needs to be an object lesson, even as we grapple with its consequences and try to determine what, in fact, we possibly can do to get a good outcome out of a situation right now in which the likely outcome isn't good.
And, of course, you're really talking about disbanding the Iraqi army over the objections of the senior American officials there, and then getting firing so many of the police and the civil servants.
Not sending in enough troops of our own and not budgeting enough money for it. And not, addressing the real severe problems that exist between the three main factions within the country in our plan. It's just sort of saying, well, we'll shrug it off. Democracy will solve all problems. And now look where we are.
It's sort of like, you know, as you're in the quicksand, and the more you struggle, the deeper you go.
Where we are now.
We're going to be back in just a moment here with our very special guest this afternoon.
The spiritual battle in which we're currently involved is Gary Carr's book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism. Now, you may remember Gary Carr's book, Ear to Global Occupation. His second book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism, goes into the very real spiritual forces, the dark and sinister spiritual forces, which have energized those people who are lording the world in which we live today. Going into the background of Masonry, Theosophy, and he actually quotes extensively from the writings of these people who have helped to mold the events of the 20th century. The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Carr will give you tremendous insight into the background of what's happening in America today. And unless you understand the spiritual forces at work, you really can't understand the unfolding of events. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Carr.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done. Get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today. 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927. Dr. Stan Monteith and so many listeners know that Miracle 2 soap isn't just soap. It's a miracle.
Leading-edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high-quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now. That's 423-0121.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here with David Rothkopf, and we're talking about the National Security Council, really the most powerful organization working behind the scenes, influencing American foreign policy, and of course, we're really in a very, very difficult time. Now, you spent a lot of time talking to Condoleezza Rice, you know. What was your impression of Condoleezza Rice? Is she pleased with the policy, or does she feel more or less trapped in what we're in today?
Well, first of all, my impression of Condoleezza Rice is that she's an extraordinarily intelligent, capable, thoughtful woman who benefits from a uniquely close relationship with the president and his complete trust. Having said that, I think she was not the most effective national security advisor because she was drawn so close to him that she was unable to play the role of honest broker between the views, say, of Colin Powell and the sort of internationalist group within the administration and Cheney and Rumsfeld and the neocon group, and I think more balance would have benefited us in the first term. In the second term, the fact that she does have this kind of entree and trust and now 4 more years of experience, I think puts her in a position to be a very effective Secretary of State. But, you know, one gets the sense of, you know, her thoughtfulness when you talk to her and she says, look, I don't think that we can judge right now whether what we're doing is right, is going to work out for the best or not. That's going to take time, and it's going to be the judgment of history. All we can do right now is proceed in the way that we think is ultimately right. But she has a historical context. She's a student who has viewed developments in this region and around the world, and studied them carefully over the course of the past a number of decades, understands American history, and I think that benefits her. Now, whether or not she and the others around her are actually drawing the right conclusions from the historical analogies they see, that's another issue, because many of them had as a formative experience the collapse of the Soviet Union and the transformation of Eastern Europe to democracies in the context of the Velvet Revolution and the other transformations that took place in 1989 and after that. And I think many of them made an incorrect analogy between that and the Middle East, thinking, well, once democracy breaks out there, we're going to see a real rolling wave of transformation, or as Wolfowitz put it, a kind of tsunami of democracy. And the cultures and the histories and the experiences in those two regions are so different that the analogy leaves a lot to be desired. And as we're seeing, while democracy is being tentatively embraced, there's also still a lot of potential for its rejection or abuse.
Well, of course, I wonder if they've ever read Samuel Huntington's book, The Clash of Civilizations. I'm a retired orthopedic surgeon. I'm not a historian, but I can respect what Samuel Huntington has written. And he warned us specifically about doing exactly what we're doing. And he said it'd result in a disaster.
Well, Huntington, of course, and I'm sure this, the reason he brought this up is because he's a former National Security Council staffer, actually did play a policy planning role looking at issues like this. With his former academic colleague Brzezinski during the Carter administration, and had studied these issues very carefully for several decades, and that's how he came to the conclusions he's come to. Now, I don't know whether the ultimate clashes of our time are going to be civilizational, or whether they're going to have economic roots, or whether they're going to be demographic between an aging North and a youthful South, but I do think that the message of Huntington's book is that very great gaps remain in the worldview of different clusters of people around the world. And for us to sort of assume naively that wherever we go in, if we give people a chance, they'll want to change and become just like us, is absurd. And, in fact, Kissinger once said to me that this is kind of a common failing of the American people, that we think, all we have to do is let foreigners have a chance to be just like us, and that's the option that they're going to take. Of course, that's not the... They don't want to be us. They want to have some of the benefits we've got, but they want to also maintain the things that are intrinsically important to them and their culture.
Well, in your conversations with Colin Powell, what we have been able to observe is that Colin Powell was not anxious to go ahead and attack Iraq, that he had actually said, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but if you break it, it's yours. In other words, if you go in Iraq and you destroy the society there, you're going to have to rebuild it. Is that true, or is that his feeling, or is that
simply... first of all, one of the people who's closest to Colin Powell said to me, one of the problems Colin Powell has in life is that he's such a popular figure that everybody treats him like a kind of a G.I. Joe doll who they dress up in a uniform that, suits their taste. And, he would go to Europe and the Europeans would go, please advance our case in front of the president. And Powell would go, hey, look, I'm not the advocate for the Europeans in the U.S. cabinet. I have my own views. And many of Powell's views regarding what to do in the Middle East are much closer to the president and Cheney and Rumsfeld than many people will acknowledge. But Powell did recognize the cost of going in with too few troops, with overinflated expectations of success, without the benefit of the support of the international community, without the clear exit plan that the Powell Doctrine, which he, after all, was the author of, called for. And he tried to advance those views. The problem was that, in the context of the inner circle of the president, Cheney and Rumsfeld, and after all, remember, Cheney used to work for Rumsfeld, and they have a many decades-long, very close relationship, and they had the president's confidence, really had a thumb on the scale and were able to ride the process in their direction despite Powell's opposition on a number of these key issues I mentioned.
And so there was certainly dissent within the National Security Council. Colin Powell really didn't want to get into the Middle East.
I think he would have supported going in. I think he wouldn't have done it in the way that it was done. But when you talk about dissent, the bitterness between Powell and his team and Rumsfeld and his team was as bad as it's ever been in a U.S. administration. Some of these guys literally could not stand each other. And they were involved in a real bureaucratic war. Now, there's nothing new there. I mean, you know, George Shultz and Caspar Weinberger were engaged in a bureaucratic war that was very similar during the Reagan years. Brzezinski and Vance were engaged in a bureaucratic war. Kissinger and Schlesinger, Kissinger and Rogers. You can go back through history. There are a lot of these things. But, you know, this was supposed to be the well-oiled Republican foreign policy machine when Bush came into office. And very quickly, We began to see that the machine was not that well oiled, and in fact, a bunch of the cogs and screws and springs were loose, and the thing was, likely to come apart.
Well, now, of course, you pointed out that Brent Scowcroft, who had been, of course, one of the architects of the first Bush administration's foreign policy, actually broke with the second Bush administration. He was very disturbed by what they were doing. Do you want to sort of develop that idea? I think that's so fascinating.
I'm sorry.
Brent Scowcroft actually was very unhappy with the policies of the second Bush administration, or did I misinterpret what you said?
No. I think Scowcroft is an important guy to bring up because Scowcroft was the model for the kind of ideal national security advisor because he did create the honest broker role and he did effectively. Balance the needs to be a powerful advisor to the president while not being a frightening rival to the other members of the cabinet. And I think when this administration started, he expected he was going to be very close and play a key role. After all, you know, I mean, he co-wrote Bush's father's autobiography. They're very, very, very close friends. But what happened was that he watched as the neocons and the more radical group within the administration gradually gained hold, and he is a very, if nothing else, you know, sort of a rigorously analytical guy who is committed to the process of weighing all the facts so that the president has the ability to make the most informed possible decision, and that is what frustrated him the most, because he started to see this administration moving on the basis of instinct and impulse and ideology as opposed to reason.
And certainly many people feel that maybe this is what's got us into this really this terrible, terrible situation we're in the Middle East. And, you know, if we pull out, why, there'll be chaos. If we stay there, why, the chaos will continue. Oh, it's sort of a lose-lose proposition, isn't it?
It is right now. I mean, you know, one can see a scenario where we stay. We gradually strengthen the Iraqis. We get some elections that have at least a modestly stabilizing component to them, that this warms the international community a little bit to getting a little bit more involved, that the stronger Iraqi government invites them in and you end up sharing the burden a little bit, and that, you know, gradually you don't have a perfect democracy. You don't have a country without tensions, but that it's comparatively stable. But I have to say, you have to bend over a lot of times to get to that one scenario that works. And it is much more likely that the democracy is weak, that there's fragmentation, that there's the potential for civil war, that the country remains violent for a long time, and that you have U.S. troops on the ground in Iraq for decades. Now, I don't mean all the troops we've got there now, but that in order for an Iraqi government that we like to remain in power, we might have to leave, you know, tens of thousands of troops there as a kind of a message, just as we've done in Korea.
And certainly here, what, 50 years after the Korean War, 60 years after the Japanese and German wars, we still have troops stationed there.
That's right. So there's a lesson. You know, there are a lot of lessons. You know, we shouldn't have stumbled into so many problems in Iraq, because we've been through these situations before. Now, you know, I mean, I think there's separate debate about whether or not we should be in Iraq at all, and I think there's fairly good case to be made that we should not. But now that we're there, that's all academic. And what we really need to be thinking about as a country is, how do we get to stability there with minimum loss of life, with minimum expenditures on the part of American people who have huge financial problems in the government for other reasons, and in a way that ultimately is stabilizing throughout the region. And one of the ways that you need to do this is also to take a step back and to recognize that Iraq was not the center of our problems there to begin with, and that we have to address a whole range, 9 or 10 major issues across the Middle East in concert in order to address our national security interests there, beginning with, number one, reducing our dependence on energy from that region. Because frankly, if there were no oil there, we wouldn't be having this conversation, and there wouldn't have been a drop of blood spilled.
But of course the oil is there, and we're in a very, very difficult situation, and we would be, even if we did everything possible to become energy independent today, it would take a decade before we'd be in that position.
Absolutely. But the point is, as we were just saying, we could be in Iraq for decades and decades and decades. You know, we can't think about the solution that's going to work next week.
Right.
We need to think about the 10-year and the 20-year horizon, and what we can reasonably expect in those periods, and how we can move towards longer-term goals. The problem is that the American people, and worse, American politicians, and worse, the American media, they don't let you think, you know, beyond the next news cycle, much less, you know, out 10 years of coordinated energy policy and policy with regard to Turkey, with regard to Israel, with regard to Saudi Arabia, with regard to Pakistan, with regard to Palestinians, with regard to Egypt, with regard to the Islamic world at large, with regard to European and other allies helping, with regard to non-proliferation or terrorism, all of these things which knot together in a ball, which is the crux of our problems, and we've got to somehow start untangling it and dealing with each of those threads in tandem, or we're going to do what we currently do, which is try to find a one-button solution, push that button, and then act bewildered when it doesn't solve all the other problems.
But, of course, the purpose of the National Security Council was to avoid getting into the mess we're in today.
Well, the purpose of the National Security Council was to provide the president with the kind of advice that would be necessary for the United States to preserve its national security and maintain its leadership role in the world, and that involves both proactive decisions about how we get, how we deal with the rest of the world, and proactive decisions about how we maintain the sources of our strength, which are, you know, have to do with our domestic, economic, and social situation, and our sort of moral authority in the world, all of which have been neglected, so that we could focus on an individual threat. I think that the big mistake in our recent reinvention of our national security apparatus has been to focus on threats as the organizing principle, when we really ought to be focusing on cultivating the sources of our strength, knowing that that is what will let us deal with a whole range of the threats that we might face going forward.
And you were actually, you were part of the National Security Council for a time, weren't you?
Well, I was in the government, and I worked on a number of National Security Council-related projects. So I was involved in a whole variety of interagency initiatives, and got some exposure to this group up close and personal. I then subsequently also was managing director of Kissinger Associates and got to know Dr. Kissinger. I founded another company in which Anthony Lake, a former national security advisor, was involved. I got to know him. And over the course of a couple of decades of being in this line of work, got to know many of these people. And I thought, you know, it's time that, quite apart from the policy discussions of the sort that we've been having now, people get to know the people. Because ultimately, that is, the X factor in determining whether or not these policies work. And, you know, the president's as good an example of that as anything. His personality, the fact that he is guided by instinct or faith or his inertial navigation system or his, you know, or the fact that he's not terribly, skeptical analyst of things, that has led to the fate of several countries and millions of people being decided, as it has been over the course of the past 5 years.
Well, I wish we had about three more hours to talk to you about these subjects, but I agree with you totally that the president has not thought these things through at all. And it's sort of like, we're going to get Osama bin Laden dead or alive. Well, we didn't get him dead. We didn't get him alive. And where we are today, really, casually count mounts, and the cost mount, and the price of oil goes up further and further. Well, I really want to thank you so very much for being with us. Again, the book is Running the World. It gives tremendous insight into what's going on today. And I really want to thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you very much.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up the program.
On the JFK assassination, it includes an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, it's not an interview that I did, but it is an interview, and you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald talking before the time of the assassination. A two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA at the time of the assassination of the American president. And then, of course, my overall analysis of the reasons why President Kennedy was assassinated. There's so much information that has not been put out, and if you listen to this four-tape set, you will begin to understand that there are forces at work behind the scenes which have been able to confuse the American people about the reality of the murder of an American president. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the JFK assassination tapes.
Are you concerned about your child's future? Well, it starts with a sound education. VHM provides for that cornerstone of your child's future with a quality education founded on biblical principles. Our school sets high academic goals while developing moral standards. From preschool through eighth grade, your child is taught by experienced and credentialed teachers in all subjects, including our dynamic music program and state-of-the-art computer classes. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." For over 50 years, VHM Christian School has provided peace of mind to parents knowing their children are receiving an excellent education in a loving environment. VHM is located at 427 Capitola Road Extension in Santa Cruz. Won't you call us today at 475-4762? That's VHM Christian School at 475-4762. Doesn't your child deserve a chance to try VHM?
Have you purchased or invested in gold, silver coins, or bullion in the last several years? If so, you've most likely been taken advantage of. In a lot of cases, out and out lied to. There are several tricks of the trade in play in the precious metals and collector coin markets. This is especially true during a hot market. Although it doesn't take a savvy investor to avoid the pitfalls of unscrupulous coin and metals dealers, it does take some common sense and the knowledge of which questions to ask. The asset management professionals at Colonial Resources can arm you with a few simple questions to ask your current broker or coin dealer. To find out if you've been taken advantage of, or if you're thinking of investing, call Colonial Resources toll-free, 1-800-685-4042. The precious metals and collector coin markets are hot and definitely where the smart money is heading. But before you make a mistake that could cost you hundreds or even thousands of dollars, call the professionals at Colonial Resources. The call and the advice are free. 1-800-685-4042. That's 800-685-4042.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show.
Well, our guest this afternoon is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a very nice man, and I really enjoyed talking to him. He is part of this group of people that really run the government, and he's our first little close personal relationship to Henry Kissinger, but I think that it's so important to listen to him. I don't think he's not a conspirator at all. But these people all go to the same meetings, they talk to the same people, and of course they see the same problems, and they agree on the same solutions. Only many, many people are really very, very concerned about what is taking place in Iraq today. And I will tell you, one of our callers called in, they said this whole issue is satanic, and I believe that's absolutely right. I believe that there are forces behind the scenes that energize people and draw them into making ridiculous decisions, and those decisions are leading America into World War III, in my estimation. For those of you who would question what I say, let me suggest you get my Occult Hierarchy Part 1 and Part 2 radio letters. They're up on the internet at www.radioliberty.com. There are other forces out there working behind the scenes that are spiritual, that are energizing the decisions that are being made. Now, if you don't have access to the internet, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to send you the Occult Hierarchy Part 2, but feel free to go onto our website at radioliberty.com and pull down our newsletters and copy them and distribute them. We hope that many of you out there will certainly want to get the booklets we're putting together. We have all of my newsletters on why we're in Iraq today, starting back with 9/11, and we put them into three booklets, Foreknowledge, Part 1, Part 2, Part 3, and then we'll give you an overview of how we got into the mess we are today, and what really was known before 9/11. They knew who Muhammad Atta was. We knew this long ago. We knew they were monitoring Muhammad Atta, and if you read my newsletters, you'll find the documentation for that years ago. So if you'd like to get the booklets, they're each $3.95, or you can get three of them for $9.95. We have one on the history of money. We have one on genetic engineering, which is really population control. And we'd be putting together all sorts of these booklets, inexpensive. You can buy them for us, or you can copy them and distribute them yourself. We want to get the information out and help people to understand the spiritual nature of the forces that we are involved with that are aligned against America today. So if you'd like, of course, to get some of the books, the New World Religions by Gary Kaw, an excellent book, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, The Hope of the Wicked by Ted Flynn, all of these will point you towards an understanding of the fact we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield, and we are headed towards World War III. So then, of course, Johanna Michelson's excellent book, The Beautiful Side of Evil, and she was a medium. And she was in contact with the other dimension, with the beings from the other dimension. Certainly the book, The Blood on the Altar, the story of Aleister Crowley. And if you haven't yet seen the videos, they sold their souls for rock and roll. And we have now, I think, the 3- and 4-hour available, the 10-hour. We're having some trouble with the DVDs, although you can get the 10-hour videos, they sold their souls for rock and roll, to understand how the satanic movement, these satanic forces have infiltrated the music that our children are listening to. That's, they sold their souls for rock and roll, 3-hour, 4-hour, 10 hours. And then, of course, the videos, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, which will give you tremendous insight into the whole history of the spiritual movement from the Garden of Eden right up to where we are today. And actually, I actually play a small part in the Megiddo 2, where we talk about the Georgia Guidestones, the satanic monument back there in Elberton, Georgia, and Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. Well, anyway, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.